Well, hey. Well, this thing doesn't move all that well. I'm just going to leave that there. Yeah, lovely to see you. It's so good to be back. I sometimes have this problem when I'm about to give a talk and I don't know where to start. And that's how I feel. That's how I felt just before coming up here. It's like, oh, where do I start again? And Gordy gave me a good place to start. So here's a poem from Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, when despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water. I go and lie down. I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come to the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief, and come into the presence of still water. And I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. I want to try to give a talk today that has to do with attention. Like, what do we give our attention to? Maybe you know the feeling of this opening line, when despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be. Do you know that feeling? So what do we give attention to? And I'm not saying we can do anything necessarily about the things that rise into our field of awareness. Like sometimes we're afraid, correct? And we wake in the night. And yet, Wendell Berry seems to be like taking out of his little pouch a compass and putting it on the table and saying, yeah, I know what this is like. And I go toward the wild world. I go toward the peace of wild things, a kind of place, which is a shift of one's attention. Like, what are we tending? What are we paying attention to? And I'm not here to say certain kinds of things you ought to pay attention to and other kinds of things you ought not to pay attention to, but I am saying all of us, I think, are in a wrestling match at times with attention. What captures your attention? And attention, interestingly enough, in Latin means, I better get it exactly right, to stretch toward. Like, just think about that as an image, like to stretch towards. That in some ways that requires a bit of the will, although a lot of times it feels like we're sort of unconsciously attending or giving our attention to things, but it means to stretch towards. So something arises and we stretch toward it, you know, like when we're afraid or in this case, the wood drake on the water. Like he's stretching toward, Wendell Berry is stretching towards something. Am I making sense what I'm saying? So I want to talk about attention. And the title of the talk is It's a Matter of Attention. And at first I thought I might go in a very philosophical direction because there's a huge conversation in philosophy and in physics and in science about the relationship between consciousness and reality, or attention and consciousness and reality. Almost as if our attention and our consciousness is a participant and changes, or at least is in relationship with the world itself, which is sort of a complicated way of saying what you think about and what you attend to creates the world, at least to a certain extent. And maybe you could just put a kind of like, well, maybe that's possible. That's certainly a shift in how most modern people think about what is the world. But that's actually not what I'm that interested in. I'm actually interested in the much more practical realm of how do we live our lives? How can we what's our attention really like? And what would it be like to play with attention and to shift it in a certain way? And what does that have to do with the sacred earth? Well, in part, what we give attention to delivers a kind of world, we could say. And if we want to have a more sacred relationship with the world, it matters very much what we're stretching toward. Make sense so far? So believe it or not, I've come equipped with poems. and so I don't know how many I'll get to. I already did one, which was not on my list. But so I want to talk about some poems, but I also want to give you some very practical things to try. There's like a poll here after everyone's. Hey, everybody. Yeah. So I want to give you some really practical things that you can walk away with. So it'd be like an old-fashioned sermon. Three things to do when you go home. Okay, so the first thing I want to say is pretty obvious, that the human mind, the human psyche, the human experience, our consciousness, our ego, our awareness is susceptible to influence. Wouldn't you agree? So you just did it. I said, wouldn't you agree? And you're like, oh, yeah, I would agree. So it's susceptible to influence. And we'd like to not think it is, like we're in control of our lives and I'm a free thinker, you know, and this kind of thing. But we're actually quite susceptible. We're quite susceptible. And that's okay. That's kind of humbling. That sort of keeps us humble. So I want to try to set this up by saying we're susceptible in three kind of major ways, and then I'll give you sort of three sort of practical ways of wrestling with this. Here's a line from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. This is for David Dean. You're welcome. Maybe you've heard it. You see what you want to see, and you hear what you want to hear, which is definitely true if you give sermons and talks for a living, because I say a bunch of things, and then someone comes up and tells me what I said, and I think, I didn't say that, you know? Nowhere near that. So yeah, you see what you want to see, and you hear what you want to hear. And that's also a kind of a humbling thing. Like, we have to admit, yeah, like, the way I see the world, I don't know how open I am to other possibilities. I tend to see what I see. I tend to hear what I want to hear. And that should shake us up a little bit. But it also affects our attention, like what kinds of things we're regularly giving attention to. I'm going to pick on some worlds. First, I'll pick on the world of therapy. Okay, so let's say, I'm sure none of this, this hasn't happened to you, but some people have trouble with their intimate relationships, okay? And there's this thing called therapy, and you can go see a therapist, right? And so let's say you're having trouble in your marriage, or a friend is having trouble in their intimate relationship, and they go and they sit down, and they're with the therapist, and they're getting to know each other, and what's your experience like, oh, hold on, let them finish, you know, finish your experience, what's your experience like, and you're listening, and you're going back and forth, and all of a sudden, after time, let's say after, you know, seven sessions, which are billable to insurance, then at a certain point, the therapist says something like, well, you know, are you familiar with the concept of codependency? Oh, well, tell us about that. And you're like, oh, you hear about codependency, and you're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, oh, yeah, that's what we're doing, and even the therapist, he goes out on a limb. He definitely, in this case, goes on a limb and said, I don't know if you've ever heard of like a narcissistic personality disorder, and you know, here are some ways you can recognize this. And then what happens in terms of attention is you go about the next week, and all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, and you start checking off little things. Oh, this sounds like a codependent relationship, or you were just reading on Google that signs of narcissistic personality disorder is that one partner will walk in front of the other, and you're like, oh, there he's doing it, he's walking ahead of me, okay, so I'm not against any of these things, but attention, when something captures our attention, and really a way of framing things, it tends to color everything else. We see what we want to see, and suddenly we're not just on a walk with our partner, we're on a walk with a narcissistic person, and we're engaging in codependent, ways of, you know, exchanging information and so forth. And, okay, you get what I'm saying. Or here's another example. I was with some strangers. I don't often get a chance to hang out with strangers, but I was at a horse show. And I was with a bunch of people that I didn't know. And it's like kind of makes me uncomfortable. I'm actually not that good at small talk. And But anyway, like people are going around and the Enneagram comes up. Are you familiar with the Enneagrams? These 9 points and their personality types, and it comes from the world of Sufi, and I'm not going to get into the whole thing, but 9 personality types. And people are like saying their numbers, like I'm a 9 and I'm an 8 and I'm a 4 and I'm, and people are like, I don't even know what this is, and they're taking the test right there on the spot. And but what I noticed in me, actually, and I'm sure everyone else is doing, especially they knew something about the Enneagram, suddenly we're looking around at a group of strangers and we're saying, oh, well, that explains why they said this, they're an 8, you know. But one person said, and I'm an 8, and I said out loud, I don't see that at all. I don't think you're an 8. The 8 is a challenger. And they're like, well, what do you mean, you know? And so I just start messing with people. Okay, see, but when it comes to attention, we like things like that. We like labels and diagnoses and types, and it kind of keeps the world tidy for us. So what you see, what's the Zen? You see what you want to see and you hear what you want to hear. So you have to say, all right, I do this at times. And maybe that's not the best mode of going about my life. Maybe there are ways where my attention can be broadened or widened or something like that. Maybe that's enough examples of that particular thing. Okay, so that's true. Here's the second thing I want to say about attention. It's kind of a setup. You're familiar with the what an algorithm is, I'm sure, and your little phones that you have with you. I'm just curious, how many have a phone with you? If you just roll back the clock, say 30 years or 40 years, and someone were to ask that in public, people are like, what are you talking about? It's just a strange new world here. But anyway, you basically know how it works, that there's something called the man that lives in your phone. And what the man does is collect up all of your data, everything you look at, everything you post, everything you like, everything you Google, everything you search for, everything. Even the speed of your searching, like you're scrolling with your little thumb, your almighty thumb, because you're in control of your life, scrolling with your thumb, and things you slow down on, we've got a record of that. And the man is there collecting up all this data. And then the man's big idea is, I'm going to give this person additional information so they'll keep doing the same thing. They'll keep scrolling. They'll keep looking. And so the man's big idea is to give you things that you think you already know, that confirm your bias and your worldview and your ideas. And so if at one point you liked an article that was, say, why Trump is the new tyrannical dictator, and you read that, you're going to see 25 more things like that. Or it's opposite. And we kind of know that. We're like, yeah, but I'm in control of my life. I'm not susceptible to it. But my main point is, the thing you're carrying in your pocket is equipped to capture your attention. That's what its full-time job is, to keep you focused in on something you already know, your bias, your ideas, your values, your conceptions of the world. And we pay, what's funny is we pay people to carry this around. You know, like, it's not like someone's paying us, we're paying for this service. So we kind of know this, I'm just mentioning this, I'm putting it in the field, like what captures your attention? And certainly the almighty algorithm captures your attention, and we tend not to break out of it too easily. There's a very famous line, it's kind of legendary, it's like one of those lines that you can't really look up, you're not sure if the person said it. I have to get their name right, first of all. Richard Feynman, he was a Nobel Prize winner in the 1950s. And here's one of his famous lines that he apparently said to a journalist. The journalist said, hey, can you explain it to me like in a way that I'll understand? You know, I'm just like a layperson. Can you put it in layperson's terms? This is what he said. If I could explain it to you, it wouldn't be worth the Nobel Prize. Now, I really like this. First of all, because there's like a general bias that if you can't, you know, it's kind of a cliche now, but if you can't explain it to a 5-year-old, then you don't know what you're talking about. But also, 5-year-olds don't know that much. Like, that's also true. And there are some things that a 5-year-old can't understand. I'm sorry. There are some things that a 45-year-old can't understand. So I'm mentioning that because if most of our attention is being captured by things that we think we already know about the world, like, it's limiting. It limits our attention. It narrows our attention in such a profound way that we're never likely to bump into something that's going to shake us. Like talking to a Nobel Prize winner on their terms. Like, that will blow your mind. Sometimes I listen to this podcast called Theories of Everything, and I am not exaggerating when I say I probably understand 3% of it on a really good day. You say, well, why are you listening to it? I don't really know. But it shakes me up. Like, you don't really know what you're talking about. And your attention, you know, can be moved over to a world that's bigger than the world of your own tiny ego, your own small self, your own self-protective environment that your phone is affirming. Okay, and finally, here's the third realm where that's worth noting. So first of all, maybe I'll just put it in a straightforward sentence at first. Groupthink is contagious. All right, groupthink is contagious. In fact, let's do a little survey. How many of you think groupthink is contagious? Exactly. You wised up. Yeah. See, you're already learning. Yeah, groupthink is very contagious, and it's emotionally contagious. It's psychologically contagious. It's intellectually contagious. Carl Jung has this great line. He says, "Human beings don't have ideas. Ideas have human beings," and so they take us over. We can be possessed by them. And you can get really fixated. COVID was actually a great cultural experiment in this becoming much more obvious because lots of stories and camps were forming. Do you remember? Us versus them, mask versus no mask. And it colored the way you saw everything. Say, for example, you were in the mask camp. If you were in the grocery store and you saw someone who was unmasked, how many of you were literally afraid? Like, I'm not going to show for a show of hands here, but no, it's like, you know, this kind of, and that's an example of groupthink, because you're looking around who's safe, who's not. And of course, if you're unmasked and waltzing through the grocery store, you know, you're also doing the same thing. You're scanning. And there's all kinds of confirmation bias that's happening. And all I want to say is human beings are susceptible to groupthink. We're really not, you know, we have to be humble about that reality. So that's worth bringing attention to. Who's capturing my attention? Who's affirming my way of seeing the world? And who's not? So bringing some conscious attention to that. Okay. That was my setup. Now, as promised, we're going to do some practical exercises here. I have three. The first I'm going to call zoom in and zoom out. Okay, we're going to practice. We're going to practice attention right now on the spot. I'm going to invite you to really, really, really focus on me. Speaking of narcissism, focus on me, okay? No, but try it right now. Like, hyper focus. Like, let's say, later on, you're going to have to give a description to the police sketch artist of my face. Okay, like, do it, like, right now. Just really, like, the words I'm saying, the motions, the sort of contours of my hairline, you know, whatever. Just start noticing, like, it feels weird, actually. back to the possible idea that consciousness and attention affects reality. So, like, I could feel, no, okay, so that's zoom in. That's zoom in. Now let's zoom out, but do it slowly. Start zooming out and try to take the stage in. You're still listening to me. You're still noticing, oh, there's Kent up there, and I think he wore that jacket before. Yes, I have, many times. And then you're including the stage and the speakers, and kind of see if you can zoom out, but you're still looking at me. Still looking at me, because it's all about me. But you're now include your neighbors here. Like, oh yeah, I'm sitting near people here. You feel how like your attention can expand a bit, and see if you can like include the room. See if you can include the building. Or if you're from Grand Haven, you're not just a visitor here, see if you can feel, while you're watching me and listening to me, where this place is situated when it comes to the city itself and the shoreline and the river. Isn't that interesting? See if you can zoom out even further. Like, where are we in the world? Okay, that's what I'm calling. It's not like it's a technique. I made up the phrase. Zoom in, zoom out. So the first thing, one of my points this morning is our attention right now is captured by all kinds of things. It's like there's a sort of tyranny of the urgent pouring through your phone and your social media feed and your radio, if people listen to the radio anymore, and the internet, and even the people you talk to, and your neighbor is going to come complain about the same thing that he complained about last week, and it's just pouring forth here. See if you can start practicing zooming in and zooming out. Like, all right, I'm going to zoom in, I'm going to listen, I'm going to zoom out. Like, what else is possible here? I'm listening to what Kent is saying, but I'm also like, all right, there's something larger at work here. There's this town is situated in a certain place in the world. And the same goes with the natural world. Zoom in and zoom out. Like, zoom in on something that captures your wild attention. What does Wendell Berry say? The place where the wood drake rests. It requires a certain amount of attention to even notice such a thing. But then to notice the water and the field and the lawn and whatever else that's zooming in and zooming out. It's like flexing a muscle of attention. And sure enough, your consciousness, to sound fancy, who you think you are in the world, grows as your attention grows. Oh, I'm not just hyper-fixated. Like, I'll give you an example from politics. Did you know that Donald Trump was elected president of the United States? Were you aware of this? Okay. Now, zoom out in terms of years. Just for a second. Just practice it. Zoom out. Like, when is he not going to be the president? Well, definitely when he's dead. Definitely. And guess what? That's not all that long. This is no way am I saying this is I'm in favor of this. I'm giving you no information about that. I'm just saying, zoom out for a second. I heard, because a friend told me this. You know these storms that came across the lake? Well, all of a sudden, the internet started firing up with, we've never seen anything like this. It has never been like this. We've never had storms like this. The government must be controlling the weather, okay? Just zoom out for a second. Like, how much do you know? Like, well, I haven't seen a storm like this in 10 years. Well, how long has the Great Lakes been here? Like, how far are you going to zoom out? Are you going to say, in 20,000 years, we've never had storms like this? You have that kind of, do you see what I mean about about attention? And when we hyperfixate, like, I never saw, it's kind of like going outside and saying, it's warm out today, you know, or it's cold, you know, when people go out and it's cold outside and they're like, no climate change here, you know? I mean, it's like, it's odd. But that's it, but okay, so that's what I'm giving you today, is kind of zoom in and zoom out as a possibility. What would it be like for you to stretch in this way? So that's a matter of gaze, is what I would say. Here's the second. And I guess I'll do a poem. I'll just do a part of a poem because I see I'm running out of time. Zoom out. There's no such thing as time. Okay. This is part of a David Wagner poem. And it's sort of advice for when you're lost. Okay, it's sort of advice when you're lost. And the poem's called Lost. And here's the opening line. So if you ever find yourself lost, this is what he says. Stand still. The trees ahead and the bushes beside you are not lost. Now, use your imagination. In fact, close your eyes. Imagine you're in a forest. Here you're in a forest and you're lost. And it's kind of a terrible feeling. I don't know if you've ever been lost, like really lost. Yeah, like, oh. Now hear his words here. The trees ahead and the bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here. Okay, so open your eyes. So here, wherever you are is called here. See, that's also a question of attention. Like, being lost in a way is made up. I know it doesn't feel like it is, but you're only here. You're only here in this place. And the natural world, partly what David Wagner is saying, is the natural world, everything in the natural world screams out of its very existence, that it's just being itself by being in the place that it's in. It's here. The tree in your yard isn't going anywhere, even if it blew over, okay? It's still, it's there. There's a here-ness to it. And he's saying, when you're lost, pay attention to the things in the world that say here, place. Here's another line from the poem. No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. This line occurs to me sometimes when I'm just walking around in the woods. No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. There's something about the categorizing mind, human mind, that says maple tree, oak tree, white pine, you know, whatever it is, that's what we're seeing. But there's a kind of aliveness to just being in the presence of any branch. Branches don't have names, really. Really, trees don't have names. So there's a kind of a wild way of leaning toward, reaching toward, drawing our attention to the here-ness of the wild world as it is. So if you're having trouble with attention, zoom in, zoom out. If you're having trouble with attention, try to bring your attention to the wildness of the world as it is, to the here-ness of things. And here's my final point. Take a look at your poem here, your bulletin thing. There's a poem in there by Annie Lightheart. I want to end with this. It's a poem called The Second Music. I don't think I've ever read it here. Probably read the Lost poem before, but I don't think I've ever read this poem. It's what she says. Now I understand that there are two melodies playing. One below the other. One easier to hear, the other lower, steady, perhaps more faithful for being less heard, yet always present. I'll just pause for a moment. Just feel into the imagery here. Two melodies. And I'll just supply some things. Like melody number one, the way you think the world works. What you hear, what you see. I know. This is the song. You ever had a song stuck in your head? Like every day. I have the dumbest songs stuck in my head. They're never good ones. It's never like Beethoven's Ninth, you know? It's like horrible songs from the Smurfs or something like when I was a kid. Just some terrible commercial that I still remember, like Juicy Fruit is gonna move you, okay? So I'm dating myself to the 80s. Yeah, how old am I exactly? I don't know. Now I understand that there are two melodies playing. See, this is someone who's stretching their capacity for attention, for bringing attention to the world. Now I understand that there are two melodies playing, one below the other, as if life itself is moving along as a kind of song, a kind of symphony, lower, steadier, perhaps more faithful for being less heard yet always present. And here's, I think, her line of what I would call the tyranny of the urgent here. When all other things seem lively and real, this one fades. It's like when things are screaming at you from your phone, like, pay attention. This is what matters. That other one, the second melody, that's lower and more steady, it kind of fades. You can't hear it. You can't hear that the world is just being itself, that it's breathing in and out. When all other things seem lively and real, this one fades. Yet the notes of it touch gently as fingertips, as the sound of the names laid over each child at birth. What a lovely image. Just the privilege and beauty of speaking a name over a child and it falling, you know. Somehow, forever, there's going to be a relationship between that name and the mystery of this being. Like, what a strange and gentle possibility here. I want to stay in that music without striving or cover. When I think about the sacred earth, when I think about shifting my attention to the real with a capital R, to the possibility that everything is alive, that everything is impermanent, that everything is alive with a kind of spirit, I might say. I want to stay in that music without striving or cover. I'd like to be in tune with that kind of symphony. If the truth of our lives is what it is playing, the telling so soft that this mortal time, this irrevocable change becomes beautiful. When we hear the second music, there's a kind of beauty. We feel like participants in a song, in a kind of symphony of beauty here. I stop and stop again to hear the second music. No, stop for a minute. I'm going to remind you of the practical things. I would like you to play with your attention, like now and forever, by zooming in and out. That's the invitation, by zooming in and out. What was the second one? How did I? By changing your gaze, I think I called it. And here, by tuning to the second music, I stop and stop again. Like, just stop. Just stop moving. Stand still. Listen. Like, listen more deeply. You know how you can be listening to what someone's saying and get all fired up about the words, but then there's like another melody beneath that? Like, who is this person? What happened to them? What do I know about this person? What do I not know? Even the person that you know the most in the world, there's a whole vast chasm that you know nothing about. That's part of the second melody. I stop and stop again to hear the second music. I hear the children in the yard, a train, then the birds. I hear the children in the yard, a train, and then birds. All this is in it and will be gone. All this is in the second melody and will be gone. Everything is impermanent. I set my ear to it as I would to a harp. That's the place I want to end. Set your ear to the second music as you would an ear to the harp. When was the last time you put your ear against someone's chest? That's a very intimate mode of being here. And she's saying, we can live like this. We can offer our attention to the world like this. We can set our ear to the second music, to the melody of the world, to the sacred earth, to the mystery of existence as it's coming into being at every moment. I set my ear to it as I would to a heart. Thanks for listening.